On Wednesday, the 18th of February, 1587, nearly 20 years after her flight across the border into England, Mary, Queen of Scots, went to her death at the hands of the public executioner in the great hall of Fotheringay Castle. Thus ended nearly 20 years of intrigue, plots, and rumours of plots of varying degrees of credibility, but all leading to one end: the placing of the Catholic Mary on the English throne and the assassination of her cousin Elizabeth. When the news of Mary's death reached London, it was greeted by the citizens with profound and unreserved relief. Elizabeth's own reaction was more complicated. Her unaccountable reluctance to take Mary's life had for some time been a source of alarm and frustration to her devoted subjects and long-suffering advisers. And it was only with the greatest difficulty that finally she'd been persuaded to sign the death warrant. In the capitals of Europe, in Paris, in Brussels, in Rome, indeed to everyone who was devoted to the cause of deposing the bastard and heretic Queen of England, to re-establishing the Catholic religion in her dominions, and removing a constant thorn in the side of that most Catholic monarch, Philip of Spain, the news came as a clear sign from heaven. Bernardino de Mendoza, the Spanish ambassador in France, certainly had no doubts. And he wrote to Philip on February the 28th.
The English ambassador sent a confidant to me this morning to say that as it was so important that your majesty should be informed instantly of the news he'd received last night from England, he sent to tell me of it and openly to confess to me his anxiety to serve your majesty. He offered himself in the assurance that your majesty would not order him to do anything against the interest of his mistress, the Queen, who, however, he could plainly see, had not long to live, now that she had allowed the execution of the Queen of Scotland. The Queen orders her ambassador to inform the King of France of it, and assure him that the deed was done against her will. Although she had signed the warrant, she had no intention of having it carried out. But her counsellors, without her consent, had executed the sentence. As God has so willed, these accursed people, for his end, should against all reason commit such an act as this, it is evidently his design to deliver the kingdoms of England and Scotland into your majesty's hands.
Philip was already thinking along these lines himself, and early in February, while Mary was still alive, he'd written to Count Olivares, his ambassador in Rome.
You will cautiously approach His Holiness, and in such terms as you think fit, endeavour to obtain from him a secret brief declaring that, failing the Queen of Scotland, the right to the English crown falls to me. My claim, as you are aware, rests upon my descent from the House of Lancaster, and upon the will made by the Queen of Scotland, mentioned in a letter from her. You will impress upon His Holiness that I cannot undertake a war in England for the purpose merely of placing upon that throne a young heretic like the King of Scotland. His Holiness must, however, be assured that I have no intention of adding England to my own dominions, but to settle the crown upon my daughter, the Infanta.
The news of Mary's death reached Philip on March the 23rd, but for a full week he made no move. During that week, hidden away in the heart of his great monastery palace of San Lorenzo del Escorial, he seems finally to have made up his mind to proceed with the great enterprise against England. It was by no means a new scheme. The English Catholic exiles had been urging armed intervention for nearly 20 years. Philip had been considering it as a serious proposition for about 4 years. And an invasion fleet was now gradually assembling in ports up and down the Spanish and Portuguese coasts, under the direction of the veteran commander, the Marquis of Santa Cruz. The King of Spain might reasonably consider that he'd been offered provocation enough. The English refusal to accept his monopoly of trade and treasure in the New World, and the presence of an English army fighting on the side of his rebellious subjects in the Netherlands, had already indeed led to a state of virtual, if undeclared, war. But although Philip had few doubts that he'd been chosen as God's instrument on earth to stamp out the creeping plague of heresy, he'd found it very hard to convince himself that God really wanted him to spend Spanish gold and Spanish blood in order to establish the half-French Mary Stuart on the English throne. On March the 31st, a spate of orders, queries, and dispatches began to issue from the Escorial. Santa Cruz was to try to be ready for sea before the spring was over. And there were further instructions from Philip for Olivares in Rome.
I can only say that I am extremely grieved at the death of the Queen of Scotland, which is much to be regretted, as she was so good a Catholic and would have been so appropriate an instrument for converting those countries to our holy Catholic faith. Since, however, God has ordained otherwise in his inscrutable judgment, he will provide in other ways for the success of his cause. This new event makes it more necessary than ever to obtain from His Holiness the secret brief mentioned in my previous dispatch. You may now tell him from me that I am desirous to push the enterprise on as quickly as circumstances will allow. You will, in speaking of this, assume that speed in the execution will depend upon having plenty of money, and so lead on to his own contribution, while assuring him of my goodwill.
The Pope had promised Philip 1,000,000 gold ducats to be paid the day the first Spanish soldiers set foot on English soil, and Olivares had been trying for some time to get an advance on this. Meanwhile, in England, in the early spring of 1587, Elizabeth was engaged in fighting a brisk diplomatic rearguard action to cover her retreat after Mary's execution. But as it became clear that neither France nor Scotland, the two powers most immediately concerned, intended to take vengeance, the Queen felt free to turn her attention to other problems, and she had plenty. Elizabeth regarded the situation in the Netherlands with quite as much distaste as Philip did. After the assassination of William of Orange, that great champion of the Protestant cause, she'd sent an expeditionary force under the command of the Earl of Leicester to help the embattled Dutch in their struggle against Spanish domination. The prospect of a triumphant Spanish army camped just across the North Sea was not pleasant to contemplate. But the Queen had become increasingly disenchanted with her allies as the money and troops from England disappeared without trace into a quicksand of mismanagement, inefficiency, and graft. The veteran English captain, Black John Norris, writing to Francis Walsingham from Utrecht at the end of March, voiced a typical complaint.
I have received directions from my Lord of Leicester for the filling of certain towns with garrisons at Her Majesty's pay. But I receive no direction where I shall have them in. Out of Flushing and Brill, there is not in the whole country 3,000 footmen at Her Majesty's pay. And as for the horse, they are utterly ruined. His Lordship's company, at their entering into this town, were not 30 men armed. Amongst all the other companies, scarce were to be found 100 men and horse able to be employed. I know not how the wars can be made on this fashion, without either men or money. And whereas His Lordship wrote that the treasure should come within 6 days, it is now 30 days since, and yet we have no word of him. The whole company's are near 6 months unpaid, and mine, 8 months unpaid.
But if the campaign in the Netherlands was proving little short of disastrous, there was another course of action open to the English government which offered better chances of success. Early in April, disquieting news reached Mendoza in Paris.
On the 27th of March, proclamation was made in London, ordering the instant embarkation of the crews of 10 ships with Francis Drake. Of these 10 ships, 4 belonged to the Queen, their burden being respectively 400, 300, and 120 tons, very well armed with bronze guns. The others are merchantmen, the largest 200 tons, but most of them 120 to 150 tons with iron pieces. The whole fleet carried about 1,000 men and victuals for 4 months. They left Gravesend the same day, and Drake went on board near Dover and sailed with the ships to Plymouth, where they were to be joined by English pirate ships belonging to the West Country. With the exception of Drake himself, not a soul on the fleet knows what the object of it is, but various surmises are afloat. One to the effect that they are going to prevent the junction of Your Majesty's fleet in Spain destroying a portion of it, as it will have to be fitted out in various ports. Others say the design is to intercept the Indian flotillas, and this seems the most probable.
In fact, Drake's instructions were to impeach the purpose of the Spanish fleet and stop their meeting at Lisbon, whereof the manner how is referred to your discretion. Francis Drake had for some time been conducting his own private war with Spain, and this was a mission after his own heart. He wrote to his friend Walsingham from Plymouth.
I thank God I find no man of our company wanting, but all as members of one body to stand for our gracious queen and country against Antichrist and his members. The wind commands me away. Our ship is under sail. God grant we may so live in his fear as the enemy shall have cause to say that he doth fight for her majesty as well abroad as at home. And let me beseech your honor to pray unto God that he will direct us the right way. Then we shall not doubt our enemies, for they are the sons of men. Haste! From aboard her majesty's good ship, Elizabeth Bonaventure, by him that will always be commanded by you, and never leave to pray for you, Francis Drake.
Drake wasted no time in port. The Queen could well change her mind. She was known to be reluctant to offer Philip any more provocation than was absolutely necessary. Indeed, she was still apparently hoping that a direct confrontation might be avoided, and had begun cautiously to explore the possibilities of a negotiated settlement in the Netherlands. And the Queen did change her mind, or at any rate provided herself with a line of retreat, and further instructions were dispatched to Plymouth. Drake's expedition was to forbear to enter forcibly any of the King of Spain's ports or havens, and was not to do any act of hostility upon the land. But the messenger was too late, as perhaps the Queen had intended he should be. And the first news of the expedition came in a dispatch from Drake, again addressed to Francis Walsingham.
On the 29th of April, we arrived into the road of Cadiz, where we found sundry great ships, some laden, some half-laden, and some ready to be laden with the King's provisions for England. We stayed there until the 1st of May, in the which meantime we sank a Biscayan ship of 1,200 tons, burnt a ship of the Marquis of Santa Cruz of 1,500 tons, and 31 ships more, carried away four with us, laden with provisions, and departed thence at our pleasure, with as much honor as we could wish. Notwithstanding that during the time of our abode there, we were oftentimes fought withal by 12 of the king's galleys, of whom we sank two and always repulsed the rest, and were, without ceasing, vehemently shot at from the shore, but to our little hurt, God be thanked. I assure your honor, the like preparations were never heard of nor known, as the King of Spain hath and daily maketh to invade England. This service, which by God's sufferance we have done, will without doubt breed some alteration of his pretenses. Howbeit, all possible preparations for our defense are very expedient to be made. I dare almost not write unto your honor of the great forces we hear the King of Spain hath. Prepare in England strongly, and most by sea.
After his triumphant descent on Cadiz and a cautious reconnaissance of Lisbon, Drake established himself at Sagres, near Cape St. Vincent, on the Algarve coast of Portugal, and began systematically to destroy the local fishing boats and other coastal traffic, which, although unspectacular, was by no means unimportant.
We've taken ships, barks, caravels, and divers other vessels, more than 100, most laden, some with oars for galleys, planks and timber for ships, hoops and pipe staves for cask, and many other provisions for this great army. The hoops and pipe staves were above 1,600 or 1,700 ton in weight, all of which I commanded to be consumed into smoke and ashes by fire, which will be unto the king no small waste of his provisions, beside the want of his barks. God make us all thankful that Her Majesty sent out these few ships in time.
Such was Drake's reputation that the mere fact of his presence on the coast was enough to strike terror and confusion into most Spanish hearts. And when he returned to England, bringing with him a captured Portuguese carrack homeward bound from Goa, his expedition had been a resounding success, both tactically and financially. And then, early in June 1587, fresh danger began to threaten across the North Sea. Philip's army, under the command of its brilliant general, the Duke of Parma, had laid siege to the town of Sluis, one of the last remaining rebel outposts in Flanders. Sluis, strategically placed on the southern shore of the Scheldt estuary, although not itself the deep water port which Parma so badly needed, was essential to the logistics of any invasion of England launched from the Low Countries. Elizabeth sent the Earl of Leicester back to Holland with reinforcements, money to pay the troops, and orders to relieve the beleaguered garrison of Sluis. But Leicester's second expedition was to prove no more successful than his first. And Sir Roger Williams, commander of the English battalion in Sluis, wrote bitterly to Walsingham at the end of July.
Considering our wants of victuals and munition, and our losses, together with the greatness of the ground we had to man, we quitted the fort in the night, leaving nothing behind us but bare earth. Since then, we have been battered with great fury with cannons, and on St. James's Eve, after their style, the enemy shot almost 4,000 shot. From 2 o'clock until 12 the next day, we abode 4 sundry assaults. Since the first day of the enemy's approach, we kept always in guard 9 companies of the 12. And for this last 18 days, all were in guard. More than half of them continually, with arms in their hands for the space of 5 days to defend the great breach. We are slain and spoiled. 10 captains, 6 lieutenants, 18 sergeants, and of soldiers, in all, almost 600. Never were brave soldiers thus lost for want of easeable succors. We have not now powder for 3 skirmishes. For myself, I wish myself dead for leading so many brave men unto their ruin. The old saying is true. Wit is never good until it be dearly bought. But I and the rest of my companions are like to pay too dear for it.
A week later, Sluis had surrendered, and Roger Williams, hard-bitten professional though he was, declared that he meant to give up soldiering and marry a merchant's widow. But King Philip was well satisfied, and writing to Parma on the 4th of September, he outlined future plans.
I thank you again for having opened this port unto us, and approve your idea of mustering the bulk of the army intended for the main business on the pretense of attacking Ostend. Having considered the danger to your passage if the English fleet succeeds in placing itself in the straits, in view of the strength and character of their ships, and the fact that yours will be so open, I have been convinced that the most advantageous way will be to join your forces there with ours. The whole force can then be promptly applied to cutting the root of the evil. We calculate that you will have over 30,000 men ready for the main business, while 16,000 Spanish infantry, a part of them veterans, will go in the Armada from here. I have decided that the Marquis of Santa Cruz will at once take charge of the fleet at Lisbon, and, with God's blessing, sail straight to the English Channel. He will anchor off Margate Point, having first sent notice to you of his approach. You, in the meanwhile, will be quite ready, and when you see your passage assured by the arrival of the fleet, will, if the weather permits, immediately cross with the whole army. You will see the danger of any delay, for until your passage is effected, the Armada will have no harbor for shelter, and will be at the mercy of the weather.
But preparations at Lisbon were by no means so far advanced as Philip appeared to believe. Santa Cruz was to spend the next few months begging the king for delay after delay, while he worked feverishly to pull the ill-assorted collection of shipping which comprised the great armada into some sort of seaworthy shape. Meanwhile, the English fleet spent the autumn in port, unrigged and unprovisioned, manned by skeleton crews and its guns in the tower. The Queen was still doggedly pursuing her search for a peaceful settlement. The war in the Netherlands, which had devastated the once thriving provinces of Flanders and Brabant, was having a disastrous effect on trade, and Elizabeth was worried about money. Only she seemed to realize how much an all-out war with Spain was going to cost, or how little she could afford it. So the Queen persevered, in the face of open hostility from her allies. And by December, instructions had been drawn up for the guidance of the commissioners who were to negotiate with Parma.
It is especially to be considered how to establish the Low Countries in peace and lawful government by natural-born subjects as in former times, without oppression by Spaniards and foreigners. Wherefore, it is to be provided that all the provinces be restored to their ancient liberties and privileges. To that end, you may require that those authorized by the States of the Provinces United be admitted to show their griefs, offering to move them to make their requests such as shall be convenient to be obtained of the King with his honor, they yielding also towards the King, as their sovereign lord, all duties and services which of right did before belong to him. And this there resteth to be remembered for us in your treaty, how we shall be answered such sums of money as are and will be due unto us by force of the contract made here in England by the States and Provinces, for the payment whereof we have possession of the two towns, Flushing and Brill. We doubt not, but the King's commissioners will think it reasonable that we shall and may keep those towns until we have full satisfaction. You will herein employ your labors both stoutly and wisely, as without such satisfaction we cannot allow any conditions of peace.
As the year 1587 drew to a close, a great ripple of foreboding spread across the whole of Western Europe. In spite of orders from Madrid that the destination of the fleet at Lisbon was to be kept secret, in spite of the forthcoming peace talks, and in spite of Palmer's attempts to conceal his dispositions, the shape of the great enterprise was becoming clear to any interested observer. And there were many observers with every reason to be interested. For on the outcome of the struggle between Philip's empire and Elizabeth's England depended the future pattern of Christendom. Holinshed's Chronicle referred in ominous tones to an old and common prophecy, now so rife in every man's mouth, touching the year 1588.
That year was many hundreds of years ago much spoken of amongst astrologers, who have foretold that a marvelous, fearful, and horrible alteration of empires and kingdoms, together likewise with other most wonderful and very extraordinary accidents, as hunger and pestilence, desperate treasons and commotions, shall then fall out, to the miserable affliction and oppression of huge multitudes. Or else that an utter and final overthrow and destruction of the whole world shall ensue.
This doomful prophecy depended on a complicated system of numerology drawn from the scriptures, based on permutations of cycles of 7 and 10 years, culminating, according to those best qualified to judge, in a grand climacteric in 1588. There was alarming corroboration from the astronomers, who predicted an eclipse of the sun in February and 2 total eclipses of the moon, one in March, another in August. These portents were variously interpreted, but no one doubted that the coming year would be a momentous one, least of all the tough sea captains and mariners fidgeting the winter away in the Medway and Plymouth Sound. In December, there'd been a rumour that Santa Cruz might come out of Lisbon before Christmas, and within a fortnight the English fleet was mobilised. But the alarm proved false, and Elizabeth promptly cut down her strength and her expenses. Charles, Lord Howard of Effingham, Lord Admiral and Commander-in-Chief, wrote disconsolately to Walsingham.
I think if I and the noblemen leave lieutenants in our ships, and the officers such as Sir William Winter and Mr. Hawkins remain here with the Navy, it will be sufficient. For before the ships can have their full number of men again, it will be a month to gather them, do what we can. And I pray we have them when we shall need, for many are gone forth, especially the chiefest men. God send me to see such a company together again when need is. I write not this to you because I am weary of being here, for if it were not for Her Majesty's presence, I'd rather live in the company of these noble ships than in any other place. And yet I would be glad that there was something to do. If you think my continuing here with the Navy served to good purpose, I shall like well of it. But methinks if there be a surcease of arms, then my lying here will make a jest to many, and they have reason. From aboard Her Majesty's good ship, the Bear, your assured and loving friend, Charles Howard.
In the new year, the Queen's commissioners crossed over to Ostend to begin their talks with Palmer. Charles Howard regarded these negotiations as a devilish stratagem on the part of the enemy. And so did that sturdy Englishman, John Hawkins.
We have to choose either a dishonorable and uncertain peace, or put on virtuous and valiant minds to make a way through with so determined and resolute a war as may bring forth and command a quiet peace. This peace which we have in hand hath little likelihood to be good for us, but to win a better time for them. In open and lawful war, God will help us, for we defend the chief cause, our religion, which is God's own cause. The subjects of this realm would not only be satisfied in conscience, but they would, every man that loveth God, the Queen and his country, contribute and do somewhat for the liberty and freedom of the realm. All Jesuits and ill-affected persons would be discerned and cut off from the hope of their malicious practices. Therefore, I conclude that with God's blessing and a lawful open war, the Lord shall bring us a most honorable and quiet peace.
For the past 10 years, John Hawkins, Treasurer of the Navy, had been in charge of the Queen's ships. And it was thanks to his efforts and his revolutionary ideas that Elizabeth's galleons were now the most formidable fighting ships afloat. It had been a thankless task, for as well as building and rebuilding the fleet to his own design, Hawkins had resolutely attacked the pilfering and peculation he discovered at every level in the docks and shipyards. As a result, he'd made some vociferous enemies who accused him of every crime, from lining his own pockets to building the Queen's ships of rotten timber. But when the great galleons were beached in the spring tides to be scraped and tallowed, Hawkins' brother William noted joyfully that the ships sit aground so strongly and are so staunch as if they were made of a whole tree. And Charles Howard wrote to Lord Burley,
"As for Mr. Hawkins' bargain, he is presently to repair to the court, where he shall be best able to answer in his own defense. But this much I will say to your lordship. I have been aboard of every ship that goeth out with me, and in every place where any may creep. And I do thank God that they be in the estate they are, for there is never a one of them that knows what a leak means. There is none that goeth out now, but I durst go to the Rio de la Plata in her."
And Sir William Winter wrote from his station in the Downs, "Our ships do show themselves like gallants here." Winter added that he would to God the Prince of Parma were upon the seas with all his forces and we in the view of them. But while the English fretted to get to grips, the Armada had suffered a severe setback. The old Marquis of Santa Cruz, commander designate of the Enterprise from its inception, died at Lisbon on the 9th of February, 1588, and Philip's choice of successor fell on the Duke of Medina Sidonia. That mild and self-effacing nobleman viewed his appointment as Captain General of the Ocean Sea with undisguised alarm, and he wrote to the King's secretary,
"I humbly thank His Majesty for having thought of me for so great a task, and I wish I possessed the talents and strength necessary for it. But, sir, I have not health for the sea, for I know by the small experience I have had afloat that I soon become seasick and have many humors. Besides this, your worship knows, as I have often told you, that I am in great need, so much so that when I have had to go to Madrid, I have been obliged to borrow money for the journey. My house owes 900,000 ducats, and I have not a single real I can spend on the expedition. Apart from this, neither my conscience nor my duty will allow me to take this service upon me. The force is so great, and the undertaking so important, that it would not be right for a person like myself, possessing no experience of seafaring or of war, to take charge of it, seeing that I should have, suddenly and without preparation, to enter a new career.
But Philip was adamant, and resigning himself to the inevitable, Medina Sidonia set out for Lisbon, where he was pursued by detailed, if not always very helpful, instructions from the king.
There is little to say with regard to the mode of fighting and the handling of the armada on the day of battle, as they must depend upon circumstances. But I have to press upon you not to miss the gaining of every possible advantage. Above all, it must be borne in mind that the enemy's object will be to fight at long distance, in consequence of his advantage in artillery. The aim of our men, on the contrary, must be to bring him to close quarters and grapple with him. And you will have to be very careful to have this carried out. For your information, a statement is sent to you describing the way in which the enemy employs his artillery in order to deliver his fire low and sink his opponent's ships. And you will take such precautions as you consider necessary in this respect.
Meanwhile, in the Netherlands, the Duke of Parma was beginning to view the enterprise with an increasingly jaundiced eye. On February the 22nd, before the news of Santa Cruz's death had reached him, he wrote to Philip.
The preparations here are now completed, and I am anxiously awaiting the arrival of the Marquis of Santa Cruz with your Majesty's armada. The munitions are on board, the transport boats are collected at Dunkirk and the sluice, and the men are concentrated near the ports, ready for embarkation. The English preparations have been carried on apace, and in face of their strength, I am of course powerless without the armada to protect the passage. My troops have dwindled sorely, and do not now exceed 18,000 men, and owing to exposure and evil lodging, they continue to die in large numbers. But the rest are still in good heart and spirits. It will be necessary for the armada to come strong enough to ensure the victory. And the Marquis must remember that the English and the rebels are now strong and fully prepared with their fleets.
There was, of course, as Palmer was well aware, a fatal flaw in Philip's plan. Without a deep water port in which the armada could anchor, the all-important junction of the invasion force and its escort was, short of a miracle, going to be impossible. The Spanish fighting ships drew 25 to 30 feet, which they wouldn't find at Dunkirk or Sluice, and the fast, shallow-draft flyboats of the Dutch fleet were more than equal to the task of preventing Palmer's barges from ever making a rendezvous at sea. With the approach of spring, the English fleet was put in full commission, and Francis Drake was itching to be off again to seek God's enemies and the Queen's where they might be found. Drake addressed one of many appeals to Elizabeth from Plymouth on April the 23rd.
If your Majesty will give present order for our proceeding to sea and send to the strengthening of this fleet here, then shall your Majesty stand assured, with God's help, that if the fleet come out of Lisbon, as long as we have victual to live withal upon that coast, they shall be fought with in such sort as shall hinder their quiet passage into England. For I assure your Majesty, I have not in my lifetime known better men and possessed of gallanter minds than the people which are here gathered together voluntarily to put their hands and hearts to the finishing of this great piece of work. The advantage of time and place in all martial actions is half a victory, which being lost is irrecoverable. Wherefore, if your Majesty will command me away with those ships which are here already, and the rest to follow with all possible speed, I hold it, in my poor opinion, the surest and best course. Also that they bring with them victuals sufficient for themselves and us. For an Englishman being far from his country, and seeing a present want of victuals to ensue, and perceiving no benefit to be looked for but only blows, will hardly be brought to stay.
Drake's ideas on the proper method of conducting naval warfare were certainly well in advance of his time, and in theory he was undoubtedly right. But in practice, it was asking a good deal, and Elizabeth hesitated. She knew only too well that the Navy was, in grim reality, the walls of her realm, and she was naturally reluctant to hazard her precious, irreplaceable ships in Spanish waters with Parma on her doorstep, and, for all she knew, the Armada already at sea. In fact, 2 days after Drake's letter was written, Medina Sidonia went in state to Lisbon Cathedral and took the blessed standard of the Enterprise from the high altar as a sign that he was at last about to sail. The most happy Armada was now as ready as it would ever be. But the wind remained obstinately contrary, and it was not until May the 11th that the fleet was able to drop down the river as far as Balham. There it had to anchor again and wait nearly 3 weeks for a favorable wind. Medina Sidonia had worked hard during the 2 months since he'd entered on his new career and was modestly pleased with the results. In his general orders, he issued detailed instructions to his officers.
The principal reason which has moved His Majesty to undertake this enterprise is his desire to serve God. And in order that this aim should be kept constantly before the eyes of all of us, I enjoin you to see that all ranks be confessed and absolved before embarking. I also enjoin you to take particular care that no soldier or sailor in the Armada shall blaspheme or deny our Lord, our Lady, or the saints. As these disorders usually arise from gambling, you will endeavor to repress this as much as possible. As it is an evident inconvenience, as well as an offense to God, that public or other women should be permitted to accompany such an armada, I order that none shall be taken on board. It is of the greatest importance that perfect good feeling and friendship should exist between the soldiers and sailors, and that there should be no possibility of quarrels amongst them. I therefore order that no man shall carry a dagger, and that all shall obey their officers. The soldiers must allow the rations to be distributed by those appointed for the duty, and must not go down and take them by force, as they have sometimes done. The rations must be served out early, so that supper shall be finished by nightfall. It is of great importance that the armada should be kept well together, and the generals and chiefs of squadrons must endeavor to sail in as close order as possible. When the flagship has anything to communicate, she will hoist a flag at the poop near the lantern, and the other ships will then approach to learn what she has to say.
At last, on May the 28th, the Armada was able to get to sea. But the weather continued bad and progress was agonizingly slow. Medina Sidonia was also becoming acutely worried about provisions. As more and more casks were broached, water was found to be undrinkable and food putrefying. Those bonfires of seasoned pipe staves at Sagres the previous year were now taking their toll. The Duke held a council, and it was agreed that the fleet would have to put in at Corunna to revictual and take on fresh water. No sooner had this been decided than yet another gale blew up from the west, and on June the 24th, Medina Sidonia was writing another of his painfully honest letters to Philip.
Seeing matters in their present position, I feel impelled by my conscience to submit the following points to your majesty for consideration. We have arrived at this port scattered and maltreated in such a way that we are much inferior in strength to the enemy, according to the opinion of those who are competent to judge. Many of our largest ships are still missing, whilst on the ships that are here, there are many sick, whose numbers will increase in consequence of the bad provisions. These are not only very bad, but they are so scanty that there cannot be sufficient to last 2 months. Sire, how do you think we can attack so great a country as England with such a force as ours is now? The opportunity might be taken and the difficulties avoided by making some honorable terms. I have earnestly commended this matter to God, and feel bound to lay it before your majesty.
It might have comforted Medina Sidonia a little if he'd known that Charles Howard was writing to Walsingham from Plymouth.
Sir, if all the world lay on it, we can do no good as this wind is. For it holdeth at west and southwest, and bloweth up so, that none here but Her Majesty's great ships dare ride in the sound, but are fain to go into the haven. I know not what weather you have with you, but here is such weather as never was seen at this time of year. Sir, the ships with our victuals are not yet come to us, and if this wind continue, God knoweth when they will come. But yet we are resolved to go, whensoever the wind shall serve, to be as near as we can where we may meet with the King of Spain's fleet. For go we will, though we starve.
But the efforts of the English commissariat were to remain very much on a hand-to-mouth basis. Its deficiencies were due not so much to a lack of goodwill, as the fighting men were beginning to suspect, but to an almost total absence of the administrative machinery necessary to organize supplies for so large a number for so long at a time. The scale of the operation was unprecedented in England, as it was in Spain, where Philip, apparently deaf and blind to all warnings, was urging Medina Sidonia to press ahead with collecting and refitting his mauled and scattered fleet and get to sea again with all possible speed. Howard, still cooped up in Plymouth, was worried by lack of reliable intelligence and wrote again plaintively to Walsingham.
The opinion of Sir Francis Drake, John Hawkins, Martin Frobisher and others that be men of greatest judgment and experience, and also my own concurring with them, is that the surest way to meet with the Spanish fleet is upon their own coast and there to defeat them. For if they have been so long at sea as the advertisements do declare, they must be landed either in Ireland or Scotland ere this. I am verily persuaded they mean nothing else but to linger it out upon their own coast until they understand that we have spent our victuals here. And therefore we must be busy with them before we suffer ourselves to be brought to that extremity.
The Queen was gradually coming round to the idea that the seamen might be right after all, but bad weather and the inefficiency of the supply system all helped to delay a decision. It was not until July the 17th that Howard, with Drake as his second in command and a fleet of about 90 ships, set out on what they hoped would be a quick dash down to the Spanish coast. But once again the wind blew up from the southwest, and on July the 22nd they were back in Plymouth Sound. On that very day the Armada weighed anchor and set sail for the second time. The Spaniards had certainly benefited from their respite in Corunna, and as Medina Sidonia surveyed his command, some 130 sail, great and small, his spirits rose slightly. Led by the galleons of Portugal and Castile, and reinforced by the armed merchantmen of the Indian flotillas and the galleasses, a hybrid form of warship driven by oars as well as sail, the Armada took advantage of the favorable wind. And it was during the afternoon of Friday, July the 29th, that Captain Thomas Fleming of the bark Golden Hind interrupted a game of bowls on Plymouth Hoe with the news that a large number of ships had been sighted off the Lizard. Whereupon, according to Howard,
although the wind was very scant, we first warped out of harbour that night. And upon Saturday, the wind being at southwest, about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, descried the Spanish fleet, and did what we could to work for the wind, which by Sunday morning we had recovered. At 9 of the clock we gave them fight, which continued until 1. In this fight we made some of them bear room to stop their leaks. Notwithstanding, we durst not adventure to put in among them, their fleet being so strong. The southerly wind that brought us back from the coast of Spain brought them out. God blessed us with turning us back. For the love of God and our country, let us have with some speed some great shot sent us of all bigness, and some powder with it, for this service will continue long.
So began the pursuit up the channel. At their first meeting, both sides had received some unpleasant shocks. The Spaniards, by the realization that they were opposed by ships faster and more weatherly than any they'd seen before. The English, by the sheer awesome size of the Armada and the great defensive strength of its crescent-shaped formation. Even with their superior firepower and maneuverability, unless the English admirals could break that formation, they knew it would be impossible to do it serious harm. On the following day, the Armada was to lose two capital ships, though neither as a direct result of the fighting. One blew up after a fire had started in the magazine, and the other was crippled in collision and had to be abandoned. On Tuesday, the wind veered. The English fleet temporarily lost the weather gauge, and a confused battle was joined off Portland Bill. According to Howard's official account,
the Spaniards bare room, offering to board our ships, upon which there grew a great fight. The English ships stood fast, and the enemy, seeing us to abide them, and divers of our ships to stay for them, as the Ark, the Nonpareil, the Elizabeth Jonas, the Victory, and divers others, they were content to fall astern of the Nonpareil, which was the sternmost ship. In the meantime, Sir Martin Frobisher in the Triumph, with five ships, the Merchant Royal, the Centurion, the Margaret and John, the Mary Rose, and the Golden Lion, was so far to leeward and separated from our fleet that the galleasses took courage and assaulted them sharply. But they were very well resisted by our ships for the space of an hour and a half. The wind then shifted to the southwest, which the Lord Admiral perceiving, together with the distress that the Triumph and the merchant ships in her company were in, called unto certain of Her Majesty's ships then near at hand and charged them straitly to follow him and to go within musket shot of the enemy, thereby to succor the Triumph. Which the Duke of Medina perceiving, he came out with 16 of his best galleons to impeach his lordship and to stop him from assisting the Triumph. At which assault, after a wonderful, sharp conflict, the Spaniards were forced to give way and to flock together like sheep. The next day, being Wednesday, there was little done, for that in the fight on Sunday and Tuesday, much of our munition had been spent, and therefore the Lord Admiral sent divers barks unto the shore for a new supply of such provisions.
Howard was not particularly pleased by the way things were going. Whenever the fleets had come to blows, the English had the advantage, but the Armada was now well on its way towards the rendezvous with Palma, still maintaining strict formation and still relatively intact. But Medina Sidonia was also running short of ammunition and was increasingly worried by the fact that so far he'd been unable to make contact with Palma. On August the 6th, he came to a decision. And according to the English account,
on Saturday in the evening, the Spanish fleet came near unto Calais on the coast of Picardy, and there suddenly came to an anchor, and our English fleet anchored short of them, but within culverin shot of the enemy.
That night the Duke sent another courier to Palma at Dunkirk.
I have constantly written to your Excellency giving you information as to the whereabouts of the Armada, and not only have I received no reply to my letters, but no acknowledgement of their receipt has reached me. I am now at anchor here, 2 leagues from Calais, with all the Armada, the enemy's fleet being on my flank and able to bombard me, whilst I am not in a position to do him much harm. I beseech your Excellency to send me the 40 or 50 flyboats I asked for, as with this aid, I shall be able to resist the enemy until your Excellency can come out with the rest of your forces and we can go together to take some port where the Armada may enter in safety.
But the only flyboats operational at Dunkirk were the tough little ships of the Dutch fleet commanded by Justin of Nassau, which were now patrolling the coast of Flanders, just as Palmer had always known they would. Howard, meanwhile, had been reinforced by the squadron of 35 sail, five of them Queen's galleons, which had been left to guard the channel under Lord Henry Seymour and William Winter. And that Saturday evening, all the English naval forces were united for the first time. A fleet of 150 ships, galleons, armed merchantmen, and close on 100 small sail. No one seems to have thought it necessary to tell Howard that the Dutch were in position, and he was determined to flush the Armada out of Calais Roads before Palmer could join forces with it. According to the report of Sir William Winter,
upon Sunday, my Lord Admiral put out his flag of council early in the morning, and it was concluded that the practice for the firing of ships should be put into execution. So, about 12 of the clock that night, 8 ships were brought and prepared, and having the wind and tide with them, and the ordnance being charged, were fired. This matter did put such terror among the Spanish fleet that they were fain to let slip their cables and anchors, and did work, as it did appear, great mischief among them by reason of the suddenness of it.
Fire was one of the greatest dangers a wooden sailing ship had to fear, and panic swept through the crowded anchorage as the Armada scrambled out to sea in the darkness. The fireships had achieved their purpose, and it was due in large part to the stubborn courage and leadership of the Duke of Medina Sidonia that, next day, his scattered fleet rallied and was ready to do battle once more. Sir William Winter's report to Walsingham continued.
About 9 o'clock in the morning, we fetched near unto them, being then thwart of Gravelines, and they went into the proportion of a half moon. The fight continued until 6 o'clock at night, in the which time the Spanish fleet bare away north-northeast as much as they could, keeping company one with another, I assure your honor, in very good order. Great was the spoil and harm that was done to them, as time will discover. I deliver it unto your honor upon the credit of a poor gentleman, that out of my ship there were shot 500 shot of demi-cannon, culverin, and demi-culverin. And when I was furthest off, I was not out of the shot of their arquebus, and most times within speech one of another. When every man was weary with labor, our cartridges spent and munitions wasted, we ceased, and followed the enemy, he bearing hence still in the same course.
That night, Howard was also writing to Walsingham.
Ever since morning, we've chased the enemy in fight until this evening late, and distressed them much. But their fleet consisteth of mighty ships and great strength. I will not write unto Her Majesty before more be done. Their force is wonderful, great, and strong. And yet we pluck their feathers by little and little.
Francis Drake was rather more optimistic.
God hath given us so good a day in forcing the enemy so far to leeward, as I hope the Prince of Parma and the Duke of Sidonia shall not shake hands this few days. And whensoever they shall meet, I believe neither of them will greatly rejoice of this day's service. But there must be great care taken to send us munition and victual whithersoever the enemy goeth.
The Armada had lost 5 ships since dropping anchor at Calais. Many more were leaking, many had lost spars and rigging, and casualties had been heavy throughout the fleet. Medina Sidonia had almost no ammunition left, and his food and water were running very low indeed. Worst of all, the wind was now blowing hard from the northwest, driving the Spaniards remorselessly onto the shoals and banks of the Dutch coast. On August the 9th, it seemed that only a miracle could prevent every ship from being pounded to its death on the sands, while the English fleet looked on from a safe distance. Then suddenly, the wind veered to southwest, and next day, Drake wrote to Walsingham.
We have the army of Spain before us, and mind, with the grace of God, to wrestle a pull with him. There was never anything pleased me better than seeing the enemy flying with a southerly wind to northwards. God grant you give a good eye to the Prince of Parma, for with the grace of God, if we live, I doubt not but ere long so to handle the matter with the Duke of Sidonia, as he shall wish himself back at St. Mary Port among his orange trees.
No doubt the Duke did wish just that. But he was to need no further assistance from Drake, for the Armada, battered, hungry, demoralized, and with an alarming sick list, was now on the first stage of its painful journey home. The English followed their beaten enemy up the coast as far as the Firth of Forth, setting on, as Howard put it, a brag countenance, although they too had hardly any ammunition left and precious little food. On August the 12th, the bulk of the English fleet turned back, and on the 18th, the ships were dropping anchor in Harwich, Margate Roads, and other harbours in the southeast. That same day, Queen Elizabeth embarked in the state barge to go down the Thames to review her enthusiastic amateur army encamped at Tilbury, where she was received with rapturous demonstrations of loyalty. Elsewhere, however, reaction was setting in. Lord Henry Seymour was sulking because he felt he'd been robbed of his full share in the fight. Sir Martin Frobisher, irascible at the best of times, had embarked on a furious quarrel with Drake, accusing him of cowardice, treason, and peculation, and threatening to make him spend the best blood in his belly. Charles Howard had other preoccupations, and he wrote to Lord Burley on August the 20th.
Sickness and mortality begins wonderfully to grow amongst us. And it is a most pitiful sight to see here at Margate how the men, having no place to receive them, die in the streets. I am driven of force myself to come on land to see them bestowed in some lodging. And the best I can get is barns and such outhouses. And the relief is small that I can provide for them. It would grieve any man's heart to see them that have served so valiantly to die so miserably.
Money and food were in short supply, and so was clothing. Howard declared that he expected to see most of the mariners go naked. And there was another cause for complaint.
The mariners have a conceit, and I think it true, and so do all the captains here, that sour drink hath been a great cause of this infection amongst us. And for my own part, I know not which way to deal with the mariners to make them rest contented with sour beer, for nothing doth displease them more.
The epidemic, a virulent form of food poisoning or typhus or both, continued to rampage through the fleet. But there could be no thought of demobilization as yet. The English still had not realized the magnitude of their victory or of the Spanish defeat. They were still more than half expecting that Parma would come out with his barges or the Armada reappear out of the northern seas. But gradually news began to come in of the wrecks in Ireland. The winter set in. And Burley and Walsingham and John Hawkins were grappling with the problems of paying off and disbanding the soldiers and seamen. In November, on the Sunday following the 30th anniversary of her accession, the Queen went in state to St. Paul's Cathedral, where she fell on her knees at the west door and audibly gave thanks for her own and the nation's deliverance. The war was to drag on until both Elizabeth and Philip were dead, but some sort of balance of power had been restored. And the first great attempt of modern times by one continental power to establish hegemony over the rest of Europe had been foiled. And as was to happen in later years, foiled by English power at sea and by a narrow stretch of tide-scoured water, not much wider than a ditch.
That was The Great Enterprise, compiled from contemporary sources by Alison Plowden and produced by Joe Burrows. The narrator was Richard Herndl. Bernardino de Mendoza was played by Rolf Lefevre. Philip II of Spain was Roger Delgado, Sir Francis Drake, Frank Duncan, Lord Charles Howard, John Glenn, and the Duke of Medina Sidonia, David March. Other parts were played by Dennis Hawthorne, Hayden Jones, Victor Lucas, and Lockwood West.